Our final shiur of the current series takes us to the beginning, that is to say, the beginning of Chumash Devarim. And there's a great deal to say, of course, beginning right at the beginning. And we'll be taking a look at this evening at one or two comments of Rashi, Yemirat Hashem, amongst other things. Well, the first pasuk, as we know, ostensibly, is a list of names. But Rashi tells us there's a great deal more to it than that. The pasuk reads, Aleph, Aleph, Eilad Dvarim, Asher Dibre Moshe, I'll call Yisrael. So these are the words that Moshe spoke to all of Yisrael. Be'eva Yardain, Bamidbar, Barava, Mosuf, Ben Paran, Uven Tovel, Velavan, Vechatzeros, Vediza, Hav. The rest of the pasuk are just names. And Rashi elucidates. Eilad Dvarim, says Rashi, these terms actually are words of tochacha. They don't sound like it, but they are. And actually, if you look at all these names, you will, and you have insight into them, you'll recognize them and identify them as places where the Jewish people angered Hashem. And when Moshe is mentioning these names, he's referring to those episodes. Lefichach, however, therefore, sasim es advarim. That's why Moshe mentions them only in the form of an allusion. He does not mention the sins outright. Mipnei kavodam shel Yisrael, out of respect for Bnei Yisrael. As we've mentioned in the past, although in the fullness of time, and as the Perek and Prokim and Parshios ensue, Moshe will go into some of these events in blow-by-blow detail, but you can't start that way. You can't start with an absolute bombardment of sin. It's got to start with an expression of Kavodam Shel Yisrael, and that's why Moshe just contents himself for his first communication to mention this list of names, the Hameven Yevin, and if a person is not Maven, or doesn't want to be Maven, so then he'll have to wait till the second day, but a gesture of respect never goes astray. And true to form, Rashi proceeds to explain, as he mentions all of the places in Pasuk Aleph, what sin it was that occurred in that particular place. And he goes to on the Midbar and Arava and Mosuf. And the Rashi that I would like to take a look at is about two-thirds of the way through, Bein Paran uvein Tofel velavan. Now what's interesting is, as names go, and as places go, Paran we should be somewhat familiar with, because there is a place called Midbar Paran, it's mentioned in the Torah. But Tofel and Lavan are not places that we're familiar with, so that's actually very interesting, because we're meant to try and get the illusion, and Moshe mentioned the place, and we say, what did we do there? But when he starts mentioning places that we never were, so we don't really have much of a chance of unpacking the remes. And Rashi quotes Rabbi Yochanan, Hamar Rabbi Yochanan, Chazanu akol ha-mikra. I've gone through the entire Tanakh. So that's nice. Someone did that for us. Velo matzinu mokam shishmo tofel v'lavan. I never once met a place called Tofel and Lavan. So what are we to associate with that? Rather, says Rabbi Yochanan, these words, Tofan and Lavan, they're not exactly the name of a place. They're illustrative of one of the sins. Ella, Shehuchichan al advarim, Shetoplu al Haman, Shehu Lavan. Lavan and Tofel, Tofan and Lavan, they're descriptive words. They're about the sin that the Jewish people spoke against, or in criticism, complaint of the man. Toflu Dvarim, they complained about the man, which was white. So Tofel and Lavan is the man. But Amor, and they said, "V'nafshenu kotza balechem haklokel." They said they'd had enough of the man, and that was, of course, very wrong to do. That's in Parshas Chukas. So that's Tofel and Lavan. So now we know. So it's a bit of the odd phrase out, because again, it's not the name of a place. Rather, it's half of a description of an aveira itself, which is interesting. Especially as if the goal is not to refer to the sin, but to the place, it's very interesting that with that sin, it is half a reference to the sin itself, and it's not even really a place at all. But be that as it may, Rashi concludes, because there's one phrase that has not been explained, Paran the place, Ba'al Mashama Subamidbar Paran, Ayidei HaMeraglin. Of course, Paran is infamous in the Torah, because Paran is where the Meraglim were sent from and went back to. Vayishlachos Moshe Mimidbar Paran. So that's that. That's Paran. Okay. Now, a couple of questions with regards to this comment of Rashi. It's very interesting. We're trying to stay in command of our understanding of the places here. Every place is an episode, and that's okay. But at this stage in the Pasuk, it starts talking about between two places. And that's even more confusing. If you say, Bamid, that what happened in the Midbar, whatever it was. Mulsuf, what happened Mulsuf. Barava, etc. But then you say, Bain Paran, Uvain Tofa Valavan, in between those places, so now I have no idea where I am. One of them isn't even a place. And even if it was, it's between them, I don't know where that is. So this, in a sense, is the most mystifying of the references. It's not even a place. It's between two places. What are we to make of that? Secondly, and we have to always be particular with these details with Rashi, the Pasuk says, Bein Paran, Uvein Tofa V'Lavan. So the first place mentioned is Paran. The second place, quote-unquote, mentioned is Tofa V'Lavan. Rashi explains them in reverse order. First, Rashi gets involved in, you know, Tofa V'Lavan, it's not really a place, but what it means, they spoke about the month. That's that. And Rashi concludes by saying, hey, you know what Paran, you know what happened to Paran? They sent the Meraglim for Paran. Well, that may well be. But the Pasuk mentions Paran before Tofel and Lavan. Why does Rashi first explain the meaning of Tofel and Lavan and only then tell us what happened in Paran? I mean, that's backwards. That's a good shine. And a third question, which is also interesting, is that it happens to be that Meraglim was not the only mishap that occurred in Midbar Paran. We were in Midbar Paran for a while, and other things happened there. For example, of note, the episode with the Misonanim, the episode with the Kivro Satava, all these things are mentioned, one briefly, one at length, in Parshas Ba'alo Sechar, and also the Meraglim. I mean, it wasn't, good things didn't happen to us there. And three bad things happened because of it. And that being the case, there is room to ask, if the Pasuk says Paran, and three things happened in Paran, how does Rashi know to attach specifically the head of the Meraglim out of those three? And we could say, balabatishly, it was the worst. If you're going to mention anything, you may as well mention the biggest. But one would like to think there's a bit more to it than that. That we have specific reason to understand that the reference is to the Meraglim and not to the other two. But how do we know? These questions are raised by a very wonderful Sefer, which is written on Rashi. It's a Sefer called Or Yashar, by Rabbi Yamin Zev Hartman. I've only ever come across two copies of the Sefer, one that my father, Zichron Levracha, had, and the other that Rav Kuperman, Zichron Levracha, had. He doesn't comment on every Rashi, but whenever he does, it's a gem. And he'll guide us through this Rashi here. The crux of the matter, the main idea that the Or Yashar wants to develop here, is that most of the places that are mentioned here are in order to allude to sins that Bnei Yisrael did. And there are beremes. The place is a remes to the sin. However, there is another sin that Moshe also wishes to refer to here. And he does so, if every sin is attached to an allusion, this sin is less than an allusion. It is less than remes. The question is, how much less can you get than remes? I thought remes was as low as it goes. So you're not talking explicitly, you're talking by way of allusion. So then what's less than that? Well, firstly, we need to find out what that is. Later on in Perek Aleph, that is to say, for most of the second half of Perek Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Beis and onwards, Moshe begins with the Meraglim. we've noted in the past, observed in the past, he does not begin with the Chet HaEgel, even though that chronologically happened first. He begins with the Chet HaMeraglim, and beginning with Pasuk Kaf Beis, he starts to get involved in the Meraglim. And then, in Pasuk Lamed Zion, Moshe says, at Jenny, huh? Pasuk Lamed Zayin, Gambi Hisanaf Hashem Begalchem Lemor Gamata Lo Savo Sham. Hashem also got angry at me, says Moshe, and told me that you also cannot enter Eretz Yisrael. The preceding psukim describe how that generation of Bnei Yisrael cannot go into Eretz Canaan. And this pasuk also mentions that Hashem got angry with Moshe and says that he also cannot go into Eretz Yisrael. The question, of course, is what has Hashem getting angry with Moshe got to do with him getting angry at Bnei Yisrael? The two angers, so to speak, were over two entirely separate incidents. Here we're talking about the Chet HaMeraglim, which took place in year two of our 40-year stay. And what happened with Moshe, Hashem's anger with him that he couldn't go in, was over the Meimaripa, which took place in year 40. They're two completely separate incidents, and why would Moshe bring them together? It seems to be not relevant, not connected. However, Ramban explains that there is a connection. Moshe wishes to rebuke Bnei Yisrael for all of their wrongdoing. Now, most of their wrongdoing took the form of sins that they did. But one of their wrongdoings took a more subtle form. That is to say, a sin that they caused someone else to do. That's also wrongdoing. And that someone else is Moshe Rabbeinu. Because the Meimaripa, however you understand what Moshe did that he shouldn't have done, there is no question, and it's clear in the Psukim, that he did that as a reaction to the behavior of Bnei Yisrael, the way that they approached him. And in fact, that place is known as Meimaripa. The abiding and enduring name of that place is Meimaripa. Meriva is contention, and the contention is on the part of Bnei Yisrael. It's very interesting. It's not called the waters of the hitting of the rock, or the waters of Moshe getting angry, or the waters of whatever else happened. It's very interesting that the name that endures is Meimaripa. And therefore, says Ramban, Moshe here wishes to bring together two ideas. All of those that Hashem got angry at them and therefore could not enter Eretz Yisrael as a result, directly or indirectly, of the sins of Bnei Yisrael. First and foremost, the Meraglim, which was their own sin of which they could not go in. And then secondly, but connectedly, Meimaripa, where Moshe couldn't go in, but also as a result of Bnei Yisrael. Now, of course, here we understand the matter is entirely more delicate, because at the end of the day, Meimaripa was the sin of Moshe. Whatever he did, and on his level, but it was a sin of Moshe. And therefore, we understand that the tochacha, the rebuke that Moshe will administer to Bnei Yisrael for making him sin, is not the same as it would be for their own sin. And therefore, that tochacha comes in a form which is even more slight than the other allusions. If the other allusions come in the form of names of places, and every place has a meaning, but there's the one sin which isn't even referred to by name as a place, but rather in between two places, Bein Paran uVein Tofel V'Lavan. And it doesn't even specify where, but it's somewhere in between Paran and Lavan V'Tofel. Well, where is that place that's in between, and what happened there? The place that's in between Paran and Lavan and Tofel is the Meimaripa, because Paran is year two, and then Lavan and Tofel speaking negatively about the man took place later on in Chukas. The wrongdoing in between is Meimaripa. And that's why Moshe, because of the expression here, a sin that they did is reflected by the name of a place. A sin that they caused Moshe to do is reflected by a non-place, but in between two places. That's Bein Paran uVein Tofel is Meimaripa. Now, with this in mind, we can understand how Rashi knows, we follow, again, the thoroughness of what the Oryashara is saying, how Rashi knows that the episode that's connected to the place called Paran is the Meraglim. Because the Torah is not referred to Paran, it's referred to a place between Paran and Lavan and Tophel. And moreover, between means chronologically between, an episode that happened in between them. If the first place is Paran, the place of the beginning is Paran, the place of the end is Lavan and Tophel, and they're linked by Bain in between the two, then if Paran is mentioned as the opening pole, then the episode connected to Paran will be the closest to what's in between them. As if to say, because the emphasis is on between the two places, chronologically, that means it's the final episode that happened in Paran that was what Moshe wishes to refer to. And that was the Meraglim, which came after the Mesonanim and after the Kivras Hatava. And that's how Rashi knows that if it's Bain Paran and something else, it's the final episode in Paran. That's Meraglim. And that, says Or Yashar, is the reason why Rashi does not comment on the word Paran in the beginning. He leaves it till the end. Because he can't comment at the beginning. If all you have is the word Paran, three things happen there, and you don't know which one it is referring to. You need to go through the process of, number one, establishing that Lavan and Tophel are not places, but rather they're an episode, which means Bain refers now chronologically. You're finally able to go back to the word Paran and understand which of the episodes that happened is being referred to. The last one, which is then Paran is Bain Paran, or Bain Lavan and Tophel. So this is a completely, not the standard like reading that we have of the Rashis, if we ever do. This is really the classic way of learning a Rashi. And from Rashi to Rashi, mitzvah to eretz mitzvah, I'd like to take a look at Rashi in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Again, we'll find difficult to read these psukim, but something that Moshe did or said that was found wanting ultimately. Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Zayin. The background is the appointing of other judges, Sari Alofim, Sari Meo, Sari Charishim, Sari Asoros, and Moshe charges them. He instructs them. He tells them not to be afraid. He tells them to be honest, to do their job. And at the end of Perek Yud Zayin, Moshe says, pardon me, Pasuk Yud Zayin, V'hadavar asher yikshe mikem, you have to do your best. If you can take the case, take the case. If it's too difficult, takriven olai ushmativ, bring it to me and I'll deal with it. I'll hear the case. Okay? You take care of what you're capable of taking care of. If it's too difficult, v'hadavar asher yikshe mikem, takriven olai ushmativ. And amazingly, Rashi says that Moshe should not have said that. Al davar ze nistalek mimenu mishpat benos tzalafchad. Moshe got a bit of a correction here, because he's saying the difficult cases bring to me, but a case came to him, the famous case of the daughter of Tzalafchad. He didn't know. He didn't know what to do. He had to pass it on to Hashem. And Rashi's informing us, and his sources in Chazal, as we'll see, that of what Moshe said in this pasuk. It seems he overstepped the way that he should have spoken. And moreover, says Rashi, V'chein Shmuel, Amar l'Shaul, we have a similar phenomenon later on in the Navi, where Shaul comes to Shmuel. He doesn't know that he's talking to Shmuel, but he's looking for Shmuel. So he asks, where's the Beit HaRoeh? Where's the house of the seer? They used to call the Navi the seer. And Shmuel says, well, that's me. Anochi HaRoeh. And again, the Medrash says, shouldn't have said that. V'chein Shmuel, Amar l'shol, Anochi HaRoeh, I'm the seer. Amar l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to Shmuel, Chayecha, by your life, Shani Modiacha She'ein HaTaroeh. You say that you're the seer, I will show you that you don't see as well as you think. How so? Where? The Amos HaHodiyo. When did he inform him of this? Give him to know that. Kishabalim Shoches David. When Shmuel was told to come to the house of Yishai, because one of his sons would be the next Melech, and he had a look at them, and he looked at Eliav, And he thought, he's the one. Vayaras Aliyah, Vayomar Achneged Hashem Mashiach, Shmuel says, that's the king. I mean, look at that. He's very impressive. Amar LaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to Shmuel, V'lo Amarta Anochi Haroeh, didn't you say you are the seer? But he isn't the one. Al Tabeit Al Marehu, do not look at his appearance. He's not the one. David is the one. He wasn't even there yet. He hadn't even been called to the lineup then. And that is the Rashi. So if we could summarize. Somehow, by Moshe saying the difficult cases bring to me, which he should not have said for some reason, and therefore he was, hard to say punished, but he came back to him in the form of a case that he did not know the answer for. And then Rashi gives us the parallel situation with Shmuel. Now the truth is that this very question, I mean these are Rashi's sources that he has available to him, is discussed twice in Chazal. One place seems to say like what Rashi's saying, but the other place seems to be give a much more benign understanding of Moshe's words here. The Sifrei, which is the Medrash Halacha accompanying Bamidbar and Devarim, the Sifrei seems to be like Rashi, for the Sifrei says, on commenting on this pasuk, Hadavar HaKasher, the difficult matters, and the Sifrei says, difficult matters are for you, Moshe Rabbeinu? Well, we'll see. We'll give you a situation which is difficult, but it's difficult in an ironic sense, because it wasn't really that difficult. But no Salafa, there were no sons. It's not really that difficult to understand that in that case they're going to inherit, and Moshe didn't know, and he was almost like deliberately given a rather easy question. And he didn't know. That's how the phrase says. And therefore, again, using our phraseology carefully, the phrase seems to see this as reflecting negatively on Moshe Rabbeinu. You said you want a difficult question, we'll give you an easy one, it'll be too difficult for you. However, there is another place in Chazal where this pasuk is discussed as well. And although it begins similar to the Sifrei, it doesn't end that way. The first opinion, this is in Maseches Sanhedrin, Daf Ches Amad Aleph, says along the lines of the Sifrei. Moshe says the difficult questions will come to him and he'll be able to deal with them, and that he shouldn't really have said that, and therefore he, whatever happened with the daughters of Tzalachat, he didn't know. However, that is not the final word in the Gemara. Because the second opinion says, that which is Rav Nachman by Yitzchak, the second opinion says, Moshe did not say anything that was amiss. Because he never said, if you look at the words, Yadavar ha-kasheh, ta'kribin o'elai ushma'ativ. Ushma'ativ means, I'll hear it. He never claimed that he would know the answer to every difficult question. He said, as the Gemara says, does it say that I'll tell you the answer? Did he claim that he would be able to always give the answer? No, he just said, I'll hear it, which means I'll hear the question. And if I know, I'll tell you. And if not, I'll ask. So that's fair, because he's got to tell them what to do. Notice when you think about it, Moshe can't say, in the interest of humility, shall we say, Moshe can't say, if the question is too difficult for you, well, I guess this, we're stuck. Or that's just too bad. I mean, he is of service to Bnei Yisrael, and he is the highest authority. He was judging all the cases before these judges came along. So it's not wrong for him to say it. If he says, I'll always know the answer, that's one thing. He never said that. He just said, I'll hear the case. And therefore, if we could summarize, roughly, the Sifrei seems to see this reflecting negatively on Moshe, and that's why he didn't know the answer but the daughters of Tzalachan. But the Gemara in Sanhedrin seems to not see it as reflecting negatively at all. If you wish to know why he didn't know the answer in the daughters of Tzalafchad, that was more in praise of the daughters of Tzalafchad. That was their great merit, that they were the catalyst through bringing this halacha down. Megalgalin zuchus, ayidei zakai. And Rashi seems to have sided with the Sifrei in seeing this as something of a criticism for Moshe. However, the matter is not so simple. And the reason why, this Rashi will really need to some of our attention. It's interesting to ponder why Rashi brought in everything that he did. As if to say, if we could summarize the contents of Rashi, it's got two parts to it. The first part is very brief. Moshe shouldn't have said this, and that's what, therefore, the case of Tzalachot's daughters, he didn't know what the halacha was. part two of Rashi. And similarly, we find with Shmuel, and Rashi just kind of takes off. And Shaul came, and said, "Where's the Roweh?" And he's the Roweh. And then he went to Eliab, and he thought it was him, and it wasn't really him. But that's a lot. Actually, Rashi's treatment of Shmuel and Shaul is about three or four times as long as the treatment of Moshe Rabbeinu. Even though it just quote-unquote, seems to be another case where a person said something he shouldn't have said. Why does Rashi even give it entries? Certainly, you know, the extent of treatment that he did. That's an interesting shaila. So as some before should point out, and Rav Kupperman Zatzal discusses at length, the answer to these questions actually, as is often the case, is in something else that Rashi said that we haven't read yet, even though we've read all of his words. We've read everything except for Rashi's Dibur HaMaschil, the words in the Pasuk that he quotes as his launch, as his basis for his comment. Because the words of the Pasuk, which are the Dibur HaMaschil of Rashi, are the two words, Takrivun Eli, bring them to me. Rashi says, shouldn't have said that. Now, what's very interesting is, no one else seems to say that. As if to say, no one else seems to see the words Takrivun Eli as problematic. On the contrary, if anything was problematic, it's the fact that Moshe is talking about the difficult questions, you should bring the difficult questions. But Rashi doesn't comment on the words Hadavar HaKoshe. He comments on the words Takrivun Eli. Why? Well, the answer, say these Meforshim, is that Rashi actually does not consider the words Hadavar HaKosha, bring difficult questions to me, as being wrong for Moshe to say. On the contrary, in that respect, Rashi sides with the Gemara, that he needs to say it, and he's not saying he knows the answer, but you've got to bring the question to him. So that's all in order. But if that's all in order, so what's not in order? If Moshe was entitled to say what he said, so what is not in order? What's not in order is the nuance of the way that he said it. Specifically the problematic phrase here, something else entirely. Not about easy or difficult question, but the words takrivun elai. The word takrivun elai. It's interesting to note that it's not the standard phrase at all. To bring something to Moshe should rather have said taviu elai, because if you have a case and you bring it, that's called lahavi. And in fact, when Yisro originally gave this plan to Moshe in Parshas Yisro and says the easy questions they'll deal with or the small questions they'll deal with, v'adavar ha-gadol yaviun elecha, they'll bring them to you. That's the way to say it. What do you do with a difficult question? You bring it to the one who knows the answer, or the one who's best qualified to hear the question at least. And therefore, this now is the criticism of Moshe. A misused word, not the correct word. What's wrong with the word takrivun? Takrivun is the way that you refer to bringing a korban or an offering. Every other usage of the word lakriv in the Chumash is about a korban, but a korban is something that a human being brings to Hashem. A korban is never brought from one human being to another. And therefore, Rashi comments on the words takrivun elai. You're entitled to tell them to bring the questions to you, but not with the word takrivun. Should have said taviv. That's what it's about. Very interesting. And that's why Rashi, in a sense, develops this idea by quoting the parallel situation in the case of Shmuel. Because, once again, what Shmuel said to Shaul was not wrong. To give the answer that he gave was not wrong. Shaul does not know that he's looking at Shmuel. And he asks, where is the Roweh's house? So what's Shmuel meant to do? In the interest of humility, he's going to send him on a wild goose chase. He's going to say, oh, he lives over there. No one's home. The Balabite is right in front of you. So he's going to waste Shaul's time. And Shaul will go, there's no one there. He'll be knocking for half an hour. Finally come back. And someone will then ultimately tell him, oh, that's the one that he was talking to in the first place. So it's wrong for you to tell him that you're the one that he's looking for? Not wrong. But again, on Shmuel's level, where is the problem? The problem is, how do you identify yourself? Shaul asked, where is Beis HaRoeh, the house of the seer? Seer is a title. in order to identify himself, Shmuel could simply have said, "That's me. Anochi hu. I'm him." But he said, "Anochi haroeh." That was considered to be, on Shmuel's level, a gratuitous and redundant use of the term roeh, with the status and the stature that that implies. And therefore, says Rashi, brings this in to the discussion. Because you see, once again, it's not what you say, it's the way that you say it, if you're on the level of Moshe and Shmuel. And that's why it is in matters of seeing that Shmuel was then taken to task. Because he saw Eliyav, and Hashem said, "Al tabit al mar'ehu." You called yourself the roeh when you didn't need to in identifying yourself, but we'll see that your vision does not go as deep as that. And that's the second case. And just as a final part of the equation here, if we just summarize what we're saying, that for the reason that Moshe spoke, again, such a subtle nuance out of turn, he was punished that he didn't know a halacha that was brought to him. And that was, of course, the situation with the daughters of Tzalafchad. But the Mefarshim ask a shaila. The daughters of Tzalafchad was not the only situation where the halacha was withheld from Moshe. There actually happened to be five famous cases of the phenomenon known as Nisalma Mimenu Halacha. The halacha was withheld from him. Other examples are the Mekoshesh. They weren't sure exactly what to do with him. The Mekalel, the one who cursed Hashem's name in Parshas Emor, Pesach Sheni, Zimri and Cosby. So if there were actually five cases where the halacha was withheld from Moshe, so how does Rashi know that of all of those five, it was specifically the case of the daughters of Tzalafchad that was the response to Moshe saying, "Bring me the difficult question"? Maybe it was one of the other four. All you know is that a case came and Moshe doesn't know the answer. Could be any of them. Now, Cooperman says, and I later saw the Gur Aryeh, has the underpinnings here. Tzalafchad's daughters come to Moshe. Again, we see the precision here. Tzalafchad's daughters come to Moshe. And they say, "Our father died, doesn't have sons, he has nachla, what do we do?" And Moshe didn't know. So he asked. And how does the pasuk describe Moshe asking? It says, "Vayakrev Moshe es bishbatan." Hashem, he offered that question to Hashem. And of all of the five cases, it's the only one where Moshe doesn't know. The way that's expressed is with the word vayakrev. Says Rashi, that's our man. That's the case. Because the problem was with Moshe saying takrivun elai, and part of what Moshe obviously came to recognize as the halacha was withheld from him, is that he had misused that word, and therefore he used it correctly. He rectified the usage of the word vayakrev, by the way the pasuk describes him, vayakrev Moshe es mishpata. That is a wonderful, again, see, so much is in Rashi, you can read it on a simple level, but as you begin to ask the questions and probe, so much comes out. I'd like to move a bit further into the parsha, to Perek Gimel, where Moshe comes to discuss the 2.5 tribes that stay on the east side of the Yarden. And it's interesting in terms of the Parshanut, to see the flow of the Psukim. If we have a look in Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud Beis. Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud Beis. Ve'esha'aretz hazos yorashnu ba'esahi. We inherited that land. Me'arer asher ad nachal Arnon. Ve'chatzi har Gilad va'arav nosati le'ruvani ve'lagadish. Moshe says that those territories on the east side of the Yarden, I gave them to Reuven and to Gad. Then Pasuk Yud Gimel. Ve'yesar Gilad. Ve'chol bishan. The rest of Gilad and Bashan mamleches Og nosati le'chatzi shevet haMenashe. I gave to half of the tribe of Manasseh. As we know, there were the two full tribes of Gad and Reuven, and then half tribe of Manasseh. Now, what's interesting is the next psukim, that is to say, Yud Gimel, Yud Dalet, Tesvav, are all about the territory that's given to the half tribe of Manasseh. And then Pasuk Tetzayin comes back to Reuven and Gad. ולראובני, פסוק ט"ז, ולראובני ולגדי, נסעתי מן הגלעד ועד נחל ארנון, תוך הנחל הגבול, etc. and so forth. So, if we summarize, and we're just kind of trying to read the psukim in a straight line, they seem to have digressed. We could say that they begin with Reuben and Gad, and then they move on to half tribe of Manasseh, and then they come back to Reuben and Gad. So it almost sounds as if the half tribe of Manasseh has been, shall we say, inserted in between among those Psukim. It's like a Reuben and Gad sandwich with the half a tribe of Manasseh in the middle, so to speak. What does that mean in terms of the Psukim? Now, interestingly, this question will actually take us back to the episode of what we know as the two and a half tribes. Because as much as the way we would describe it, there is two, and we can identify them as Gad and Reuben and half of Manasseh, it's true. But it's also true, if you read the psukim carefully, in last week's parshios, at the end of Matos, for almost the entirety of that perek Lamed Beis, you do not hear a word from or about the half-tribe of Manasseh. It's all about Reuben and Gad. They're the ones who have the idea. They're the ones who negotiate. You never hear a word about the half-tribe of Manasseh, mamish, until the very end. And additionally, part of what that means is when Moshe has the famous Tznai, what's known as the Tznai of Bnei Gad Ubnei Reuven, that condition, if you go first in the war, then you can settle here. I'm sorry, I must apologize for the state of my voice here. There's a talent in speaking which is called speaking off the cuff. Off the cuff is not exactly as enjoyable, but Mitzvah Shem will make it to the end. The famous condition, stipulation, if you go first, and then you'll settle on the east side. Even that condition did not involve the half tribe of Manasseh. They literally come in right at the end. It's also very interesting, if you know the geography a little bit, that the half tribe of Manasseh got a disproportionately large size amount of the territory there on the east side. So what's behind all of this? So is it two tribes? Is it two and a half tribes? What's the role of the half tribe of Manasseh here? It's a little bit less clear than the other two. Well, the answer, interestingly, comes out from a fascinating discussion in the Yerushalmi and Maseches Bikurim. You see, the Mishnayos there discuss which of the mitzvos, land-based mitzvos, in Eretz Yisrael also apply to the east side of the Yarden. And some of them do, because to a significant degree, the east side of the Yarden came to attain the status of Kedushas Eretz Yisrael. Now, therefore, Trumas and Maisras and Shemitah and all of that applies min haTorah to the east side of the Yarden as well. But the Yerushalmi and Bikurim comes then to talk about the question of Bikurim. Is a person who lives on the east side of the Yarden, does he also bring his first fruits to Beis HaMikdash as part of Bikurim? And the answer is no. So there's Trumas and Maisras, yes. Shemitah, yes. Bikurim, no. Why is Bikurim different than the others? So the Yerushalmi gives two reasons. Firstly, says the Yerushalmi, because with all due respect to the east side of the Jordan River, but there is a designation of Eretz Yisrael which is called Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash, right? That high ultimate quality, flowing with milk and honey, and the Yerushalmi states that the east side of the Yarden, for whatever it has, it is not Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash, and because the term Zavas Chalav Udvash is used in conjunction with Bikurim, therefore, you only bring Bikurim, not only from land that has Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, but it has the higher designation of Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash. That's the first reason why the east side is out for Bikurim. It's not Zavas Chalav Udvash. But then secondly, says the Yerushalmi, a very different reason, and that is, it's part of the declaration that a person makes when he brings Bikurim, what's known as Mikra Bikurim. He says, I've now brought my first fruits from the land, Asher nosata li Hashem, that you gave me, Hashem. Says Yerushalmi, Hashem didn't really give the land to those two and a half tribes. I mean, he didn't give the east side. They took it. Now, in the end, Hashem agreed, as we say, "V'nasan atam l'nachala," as we've mentioned in the past. The land of Canaan in Tehillim Kuf Lamed Hey, we say, "V'nasan atam v'manachus Canaan." But in Kuf Lamed Vav, the Kila Olam Hastos, when we only talk about Sichon and Og, we say, "V'nasan atam l'nachala." Interesting to note the difference. And what is the difference? Well, the Radak explains that, Rav Dovid Tevel explained that Nachala is the inheritance. Le Nachala is something that became as an inheritance. That's the Isai. It wasn't the original inheritance, but they asked for it and they got it. It's important to note that the Pasuk does say in Yehoshua, it was given to them, Api Hashem Biyad Moshe. But they took it. Aha. So that's actually quite a different answer. You can't say, you can't bring Bikurim from a land that you took and say, I'm bringing fruits from the land that you gave me. So then the Yerushalmi in classic fashion says, well, we've given two reasons. Let's not forget. Number one, it's not Zavas Kol HaVidvash. Number two, it wasn't given to you, you took it. What's the difference between those two reasons? Are they the same thing? And the Yerushalmi amazingly says no. Yerushalmi says, the difference between them is, what about the territory that's owned by the half-tribe of Manasseh? Do they bring Bikurim from that territory? It will depend what the reason that excludes it is. If it's an issue of not being Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash, so their territory is also not Zavas Chalav Udvash. But if it's over the fact that you can only bring Bikurim from land that was given to you and not land that you took, says the Yerushalmi, Reuben and Gad took that land on the east side. Manasseh didn't, it was given to them. They would bring Bikurim from the east side. That's the difference between them. But what is the meaning of this idea that Manasseh was given that land? They didn't take it in the way that Reuben and Gad took it. What are we to make of all of this? And the Netziv writes about this at length in his Perish HaMikdavar and explains. The truth of the matter is that it was only ever really Reuben and Gad that wanted to stay on the east side. Manasseh never thought about it. They had no such designs. However, they became requisitioned, some of them, to stay on the east side. Why? To take care of Reuben and Gad. Now, why do Reuben and Gad need taken care of? Well, the background to Reuben and Gad wanting to stay on the east side, as is explicit in the Pasuk, is that they had much cattle, they had a lot of flock, and they had a lot of assets. Now, there's an elevated way of approaching that, and it can be kosher. They really, really felt that this was what Hashem is talking to them and signaling that maybe they should really be settling here, whatever it would be. It can be in the Shem Shamayim. One can be involved in material things, the Shem Shamayim, but one can also be involved not the Shem Shamayim. There is a danger that those two tribes, if they're left by themselves and they're occupied with all of those involvements, Mikne Rav, and everything that goes with it, and then they could, nothing much will come of them, and their Lashem Shamayim could quickly fade, and they'll be separated from really the national program of the Jewish people. Enter half the tribe of Manasseh. What's the yichus of Manasseh? It says in Netziv, there's certain tribes that are famous as being Bnei Torah tribes, they're particularly of high spiritual quality. We know of Levi and of Yisachar. Manasseh is one of them. Manasseh, they're high caliber Tamini Chachomim. We find they're referred to in Shiras Devorah, in Shoftim, in Perakeh. And she talks about Manasseh. She says, Mini Machir, from Machir, Ben Manasseh, Yardu Mechokikim. Mechokikim are legislators, lawmakers. I mean, these people were Torah scholars. And therefore, says the Netziv, that's the background to Moshe actually requesting of at least half of Manasseh stay with them, keep an eye on them, keep them on point, keep them inspired, keep them tachlis orientated. And that's really what's behind the fact that we never really find Manasseh involved in the negotiating stages where they were requesting to stay, because they never requested to stay. They had nothing to do with this Mamish until the very end, when Moshe asked him to come in. And because Moshe asked him to come in, of course we can appreciate that he certainly does not stipulate with them that you could only stay on the east side if you go first in the war. They don't want to stay on the east side. It's Moshe's idea. So he's certainly going to be condition free. Not only is it condition free, but their territory was larger than the other. These are incentives because he's looking to convince them and persuade them to stay, which in the end they do. And says the Netziv, what you see how the psukim really communicate this now in our parsha, in Parshas Devarim. The half tribe of Menashe in the middle, as we said, of the psukim dealing with God and Reuven, because that's exactly where they're meant to be. And so Moshe put them. He meant to put them that they should be together with them, to be keeping an eye on them. And that's how the Torah begins with God and Reuven, moves on to Menashe and comes back to God and Reuven to envelope them, in order to highlight the fact that they were there to be amongst the others, to be a good impression on them. And all of this is really, as we said, generated by the Yerushalmi, which said that unlike the other two tribes who took their inheritance, Menashe was given their inheritance. That really was not their initiative at all. So that's a fascinating perspective on the half of the 2.5 tribes on the east side. I'd just like to conclude with something from the Haftorah for this week, unless things change. Is Shabbos Chazon, it's number 3 of the Tlosa de Peronusa, those 3 Haftoras of disaster, really, of calamity. And it's Chazon Yishayahu, Yishayah Perek Aleph. And one of the psukim, where Hashem is saying, it almost sounds like he's not interested in the Jewish people anymore, not interested in their mitzvahs, not interested in what they're doing, they're too corrupt. And the pasuk Yud Gimel, the Perek Aleph, says, Lo so sifu, Haviu minchas shav. Enough already. Stop with your kavanos. That's really what it sounds like he's saying. Don't bring any more minchas which are shav, worthless. Ketores to'eva hili. The ketores is an abomination. And Meshech Chochma discusses this very, very difficult pasuk. It was difficult to read, to hear. You see, the message generally, of course, seems to be that if the Jewish people aren't acting the way they should, so Hashem is not interested in their korbanos. But he doesn't mention korbanos generally. He doesn't say, don't bring korbanos that are worthless, although other Nevi'im will say that, and do. But he specifically identifies 2 types of korbanos which are very specific. Number 1 is a mincha, which is a flower offering, and number 2, ketores. I mean, they're both korbanos of, you know, branches of korbanos. But why them specifically? And moreover, why is it that between these two, the mincha is called minchas shav, a worthless mincha, and the ketores is called ketores to'eva, ketores of abomination. Why is it abomination? Because the Jewish people aren't acting the way they should. So then they're both worthless and they're both abominable. So how do these two designations, what exactly are they trying to tell us? And Meshech Chochma explains, there's an underlying theme here. Generally speaking, any korban that can be brought by an individual can be brought by more than one individual. It can be brought by a group. It can be brought by partners. An ola, a shlamim, they can have a partnership, and together they'll bring a korban. Exception to the rule is a mincha. There is no such thing as a mincha of partners, a mincha of shutvim, that is co-owned. Because the pasuk always talks about nefesh, nefesh ki takrif. It's got to be one soul, not 2. Okay, so now we know. There is a mincha of shutvim, of a partner, is not acceptable. They're not accepted, not kosher. However, it is true, interestingly, that if there's more than one person, the mincha is no good. But there are minchas that are brought on behalf of the entire Jewish people. All the korbanos, the not all, but the communal korbanos, u mincha sav niskat. That's a mincha. A communal korban. It's not just one person. It's the whole tzibur. Whatever happens to the idea that it can only be one nefesh. The point is, says the Meshech Chochma, the entire tzibur is one nefesh. The entire community is one soul. It's one entity. If it's everyone, it's one. It's the one entity, composite entity, which is called the Jewish people. And that's very interesting without getting into the fascinating halachic discussions here, because it turns out that have a group of individuals, and they are just that, a group of individuals, and there's too many because there's only room for one. But sometimes you can have an integrated, composite whole, and then it's one again. And every person is a part of that oneness, and you're back to nefesh, and it's okay. Interestingly, the idea of of unity is very much an integral part of the Keteris as well. Because it happens to be that one of the 11 ingredients of the Keteris actually has a terrible smell. And the Gemara talks about this. It's the chelbana. Sorry about the parent, chelbana. The chelbana, galbanum, I believe it's called in English, which is basically chelbana, has a terrible smell. However, says the, but it's part of the Keteris. Why? Because by itself it has a terrible smell, but when you mix it together with the others, its pungency is number one, mitigated, mollified, and subdued, and number two, it's channeled in a way that actually brings out other qualities within the other 10 ingredients. Very interesting. And the Gemara itself makes the connection between that idea, how those spices work, and how people work. The Gemara says that the Chelbana represents the Jewish people who are not exactly as they should. But you bring them together, and they can be channeled. They can be sublimated. They can be focused and elevated. And if they're integrated, because they can learn a lot from everyone else, 10 to 1. And when they do learn from, and when they're subdued and mollified, their own qualities can actually enhance the others as well. And that's why the Gemara says, if you have a Tanis Tzibur, a communal fast, where there are no sinners there, so the fast is almost a waste of time. Because it's like bringing Keteris without the Chelbana. So you kind of miss the point. That the Gemara says in Krisus and Daf Vav. But these ideas, these lofty ideas, whereby even Rishayim, when they come together as part of the group, it can be a very, very positive thing. But that's only if they're integrated, because then there could be a chance that they really will learn positive things, and then they can make their own positive contribution. but if there is no sense of togetherness, if they're physically together, they can just be a bad influence, just like a good old-fashioned bad influence. So that's what it depends on. Are there feelings of connectedness or separateness? If they're separate, so nothing good comes of it. The Pasuk earlier on identifies that at the time when Yeshaya is talking, people did not really have time for each other. They weren't interested in each other. He calls them Kitzine Sodom, officers of Sodom. That's a very dubious distinction. Officers of Sodom. Shimon of Kitzine Sodom, Hazinu, Teras Elokeinu, Am Amora. Sodom and Amora, who are characterized by not having any time for anyone. Looking out for themselves. That's how people were. But if that's how people are, so then there is no tzibur. And if there's no tzibur, so if korbanos generally are not really desired at that stage, there are two korbanos that forget about them specifically, and they are mincha and keteris. Why mincha? Because if there's no tzibur, you can't bring a mincha, because you need one nefesh to bring a mincha, either one individual or everyone together. But if everyone's not together, the minchas shav, it's a waste of time. It's a non-korban. Is there anything worse than a non-korban? Yes, keteris of to'eva. And why is the keteris called to'eva? Because it's the equivalent of having the chelbana, which has that terrible smell, and nothing really ever really happens to it. So it's just there and brings a terrible smell to the keteris. That's a to'eva now. And all of that is a function of the fact that the people at that time had allowed attain that distinction called Kitzine Sodom. And Meshech Chochma goes further. And with this we'll conclude just the last final 2 or 3 minutes. Because a fascinating interpretation of the Gemara. The Gemara says the reason why Yerushalayim was destroyed is because no one rebuked anyone else. Gemara in Shabbos and Daf Kuf Yud Tes. And it quotes a pasuk from Eicha to demonstrate this point. Hayu Sareha Ka'ayalim, that the officials, the officers, they were like ayalim. They were like gazelles. What's a gazelle? What? So the Gemara says that just like ayalim, the way they walk is that as they proceed, each one's head is by the tail of the other. And that's how it was with the Jewish people. Everyone kind of had their head down, so to speak. Right? Their head was just by the tail, like their head in the sand. And no one was paying attention or looking out for anyone else. That's the simple understanding of the Gemara. But the Meshech Chochma explains it means something else. Actually, there's two ways a person can be rebuked or chastised for their deeds. either by a formal act of rebuke, someone talking to them and telling them to better their ways, which can only really happen by someone who's on a higher level than you and you recognize them as such. People don't accept that type of frontal rebuke from their peers. You've got to recognize this person is in a different league, he's in a different station, I'm prepared to listen. Reluctantly, but I'm prepared to listen. But there's a type of rebuke, actually, that you can only get from your peers, and that is rebuke through example. In other words, you look at the person to the right and to the left, they're like you, but they're doing much better. That's a certain type of rebuke, if you notice it, that works in a way that rebuke from a rabbi doesn't work, or a great person doesn't work. It's from your peer. You'd never accept rebuke from them, but you can learn by their example more than you can learn by example of a great person. Because he's a great person, so what do you want from me? But your peers, your fellows, your equals, they're like you, but just a bit better, you can learn from them. And that's what it means when it says, people did not receive rebuke from each other. No one was prepared to notice anything positive about anyone else. And the reason why is because they were separate from each other. Kitsine sado. You see, and it's such a profound insight of the Mishnah Chochmah. What determines whether when you look at someone who's your peer, do you see something positive or negative? It depends whether you feel connected with them or not. If you're connected with them and you value them, you'll notice the things that are valuable about them. But if you're disconnected from them and you do not value them, you will notice the valueless things about them. And that's why it says, Ayusara ka'ayalim, everyone, they were like, you know where the head was? By Plony's tail. By his weak spots. His lower points. Not by his head. Zanab and Rosh are the lower echelons and higher echelons, the lower levels, higher levels. Everybody only saw the other person's tail. No one saw their head. As if to say, maybe I could be more like them. Because all they say, not me, like him, have you seen his tail? And all of this is symptomatic of being like Kitsine Sodom. That's how it goes together, because if they're not interested in looking out for each other or being connected with each other, they're practically doomed only ever to see negative points. And that is a very important lesson really for us. And we take to heart, and to finish in a positive note, as the Mesha Chochma in its Perush to the Haftarah of Shabbos HaGadol, which begins with the words of Arva Lashem, Minchas Yehuda of Yerushalayim. We look forward to a time when Hashem once again will enjoy the Mincha of Yehuda Yerushalayim. What's so enjoyable about it? Because once again the Jewish people will be back together again. When they bring a Mincha, it will be one nefesh. That's a good mission statement upon which to end at this stage. We should have the Besuras Tovas, which we desperately need. Bekarov and Bechlala Beprat. We should be on the way forward, Mitzvah Hashem, to the Geula. Just to mention again, we'll be taking a 3-week break, and our next session, Mitzvah Hashem, will be Rosh Chodesh Elul, 21st of August.